I'm Austin Meek with Waco Business News, and you're listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business. My guest today is Lefty Colbert, a visual artist and co-owner of Infamous Ink, Waco's oldest tattoo and piercing shop. We talk about the history of tattooing, how it entered the mainstream, and what he did during the pandemic when his parlor was forced to be closed. Please enjoy this interview with one of the small business owners, civic leaders, and engaged citizens sparking Waco's revitalization. Welcome to Downtown Depot.
How's it going?
Great, man. I'm so happy to be here with you. Since I started this show in September 2016, I've been dying to talk to you. You were one of the first artists that I heard about when I first moved here to Waco and became friends with a buddy of ours, Cody Benton, who has a long history with you and loves your work. And I'm just excited to have you on the show and have more people know about you. So tell our listeners, what is your history in this area? What's your Waco history?
I've been here now in Waco for 18 years. I tattooed in Austin prior to this, a little while in Killeen, in different areas. But I came here, like I said, about 18 years ago. My dad had gotten sick and was in the VA. So that's kind of what migrated me towards Waco. At that time, I was living in Temple, and I'd considered opening a tattoo shop there. But Temple actually had a city ordinance against tattooing. It wasn't allowed anywhere in the city limits. So,
and that's kind of like a public thing, like we think it's a public bad if we allow tattoos, so we don't want to let that here. Is it like
in the way
that some places don't allow alcohol?
Yeah, well, tattooing in some areas is still considered a, let me think of the correct wording, a place of ill repute.
Yeah.
Which I don't
like
understand why it could still
business,
be. Yeah, basically. So, you know, a lot of times if someone, say someone's on probation and they want to go to come to work at my shop, they have to get special provisions by their probation officer to be able to do so. Falls under the category with like adult entertainment and stuff like that, which I don't know why it'd still be on the books as that, because we pierced, you know, 5-year-olds' ears and stuff. So it's become a lot more family-based. So anyways, Temple had this ordinance against tattooing, and I'd gotten to this point where I was ready to open a shop. I had a daughter on the way, and so I didn't want to go to Killeen. I'd already been there, and it was just not my spot. And so I started looking from Temple, where's the closest spot that I could find. And I actually ended up with no idea of the town or anything like that, but at this little spot in Lorena. And then at the time, it was basically like a 900-square-foot little shack on the side of 35. But it was something I could afford. It was as close as I could get to Temple legally and be able to rent something. And so I could retain all my clientele bases there. And so I did that and was there for about 4 years in Lorena before moving into Waco. And, you know, at the time, it wasn't Infamous Ink. It was Southern Culture Custom Tattoos. So, yeah, that was on Franklin to begin with. And then we kind of spread out around Waco. And eventually, 10 years ago, almost to the day, we started Infamous.
How did you first get into tattoo art?
Long story. So we got 30 minutes here. It's probably going to take the whole thing.
We got time.
Yeah, kind of a funny story. So, my dad was, nicest way to put it, he was an outlaw. So he was in prison when I was young. He got out when I was a teenager, and he started getting tattooed in prison more. And when he got out, he could see that I spent a lot of time drawing while he was in. So he actually brought home some stuff and was like, here, kid, you know, learn how to use this stuff. Me and my friends want tattoos. So when I was 13, I started tattooing my dad and his friends. Not what I would suggest anybody nowadays to do. It definitely isn't the correct way to get into it, but it's what I did. I tattooed them and other people from 13 until I was 18, and then started tattooing professionally in the 90s. And I mean, I worked a lot of other jobs back then just to try to pay the bills and keep up with everything, because, you know, then tattooing wasn't a big money-making thing. You know, there wasn't everybody getting tattoos. It was a very limited amount of people. So I can remember when I was like 5 years into tattooing, and I was sitting there and having a conversation with a guy, and it came to me. I was like, you know, if I could just make $300 a week tattooing, just $300 a week, I'm set. I wouldn't have to work any other jobs. I could just tattoo. And now, I mean, it's progressed to where, you know, it's way beyond that. So
you had talked about how in the 90s there was a smaller group of people who were seeking tattoos, a lot of folks who were in and out of prison. And at some point, tattooing really entered into the pop culture.
Yeah.
And I think that, correct me if I'm wrong here, but one person who helped popularize tattooing is Ed Hardy. And Ed Hardy had this magazine called Tattoo Time that did a great job of focusing on lots of nondescript tattoo artists working all across the world, people like Michael Malone, Tom DeVita. And the 90s was when we started to have this groundswell of information with the internet where you could see what tattooing looked like in Japan versus, you know, here in Texas.
Yeah.
What would you say was the reason that tattooing became so popular as a culture? Were there people or things that happened that allowed this tipping point where tattoos kind of became the norm?
Sure. Yeah. It's interesting because I've been now in this 27 years, so I've seen that full transition from, you know, back when I started, it was GIs getting tattoos, some dancers or entertainers, they would come get some, you know, bikers. Every once in a while, you'd have the drunk frat guy or something like that, but it wasn't this mainstream, everybody's getting it deal. And, you know, Ed, he's always been very progressive in tattooing as far as new things coming out and being on the edge of that. But, you know, not so much, I wouldn't say that his effect hit so much here in Texas as I would the internet being a big factor, a huge factor. And it being taken into mainstream when it started coming into the bands and entertainers and actors and things of that nature. You know, it seems like trends always start to follow that. And when I look back at, you know, I've tattooed a lot of bands through the years. And, you know, back in the 90s, when you'd see these guys in bands, they would get one or two tattoos on their arms. And that was it. You know, you didn't see people, especially like myself back then, that arms, neck, everything's covered in tattoos. It was very, very rare, you know, even for the tattooers. So as the band started to get tattooed more and everything like that, that, you know, the artwork in itself started to spread more across the internet. And then as soon as television caught on to it and started doing shows like Inked, Miami Ink, LA Ink, Ink Master, that's when it just completely blew up. You know, once it became mainstream to the point that you saw tattoo artists doing actual artwork, not just something off the walls, on, you know, athletes, celebrities, all that kind of stuff, then it hit mainstream. And I mean, we've been riding the wave ever since. It seems to be progressively getting bigger and bigger. And now you see the soccer moms, you know, four kids pulling up at Applebee's and they're getting out fully sleeved. So it's like, it's gone from this very risque kind of underground thing to where it's more common than not.
I don't have any tattoos yet, but I love following tattoo artists and seeing the ways that style is so different from another's. Your tattooing seems to have really incredible portraiture. Mm-hmm. Like, you can take someone's arm and it looks like you've been painting on a canvas. Mm-hmm. If I were a customer of yours singing Lefty's praises, what would I be saying about your style? What is it about you and the way that you draw that is unique in the world of tattooing?
I mean, I specialize in a style that is photorealism. I prefer black and gray, but I also do color. But my main focus is black and gray. It's just what I prefer myself as an artist in all forms. And there's studies on that as, you know, to how your brain functions, you know, if you're a tonalist or a colorist, and it's how your brain perceives things. And so for me, I'm a tonalist is what it breaks down to. And so if I see a black and gray photograph, it's more appealing to me and it just speaks more emotionally to me than a color one would. But, you know, when I started tattooing, there was kind of like this set form all the time, everywhere, that all shops had all this flash on the walls. It was basic designs of anything that the tattooers could draw up and put up there with pricing.
And what does flash mean? Is that just the basic stencils?
Yeah, you know, it's when you walk into a tattoo shop, or if you've never been one, it's just a sheet of paper. It's normally like 11 by 14 that has six or eight designs on it that are fully colored, everything like that. A lot of the tattoo shops would have pricing on them or numbers on that flash sheet. And you would pick those designs. There's, you know, and that's how when you see people from the 90s and back that have tattoos, it's a lot of the same tattoos. You know, you see the old veterans from World War II. They all got the same, you know, Eagle Globe and Anchor flag, you know, all the same stuff on their arm because the designs were really limited to then. But
and was that a technology thing, or was that a lack of creativity from the tattoo artists? Like, they hadn't thought somebody might want my own original artwork rather than just this eagle clutching a globe?
Well, you know, the thing about it is, back in the beginning of tattooing, well, I wouldn't say the beginning of tattooing because it was very ritualistic and tribal and everything, but in modern electric tattooing, I wouldn't say they were artists so much. You know, they were just there's kind of like this funny Northeast term, scab merchants. Like, they were kind of like this underground band of pirates, basically, you know, and their artwork wasn't the greatest. You know, that's why, like, traditional tattooing is very simplified. It's not like these real elaborate, beautiful designs. They're just strong lines, four colors, boom, it's on you, you know. And, you know, that's been a big progression in tattooing, is taking it from that to actual art forms and art students and people that study art doing it. And so, you know, the traditional designs were all basically the same. The flash was all the stuff on the walls, and you would walk in and basically pick a number. And, you know, your options were maybe changing a color or changing the size. There really wasn't this walking in and it becoming a custom thing. I would say that, you know, me and some of my peers were in that first wave of wanting to branch out away from that and get into being able to push the boundaries of what we saw in other forms of art and other mediums and trying to put that on skin. And, you know, it's kind of like to make an omelet, you got to break some eggs. So, you know, there was a big area there in the 90s that the greatest tattoos weren't happening. You know, like, it was the experimental stage of what is now great. So a lot of stuff that now we're having to go back and rework and rethink, but it's become a norm now. So, you know, that's kind of where my style came in, is I had nobody to teach me how to do portraits. You know, there was no, you know, this is the portrait guy that you go learn from. And back then, nobody would teach anybody if you knew anything. It was like this, I know this, nobody else can know it. I have to keep this secret, because there wasn't that much money to be made. So if you knew something, you had a style or anything like that, you had to keep it to yourself. You didn't want to teach everybody else so you could make a living. And so, you know, it was just the desire. I always, you know, I liked black and gray photography. I liked things that appealed to me like that. But that also goes back to how I started. And when I started tattooing, I didn't have a bunch of colors. I didn't have all that stuff. I didn't have flash. I was tattooing stuff on my dad and all these other guys. It was just whatever came off the top of my head. So it was more, although I've never been to prison, it was more in that prison style. And then, you know, as my career developed, I went through stages of, okay, I want to be modern. So I did all the new school, big colorful stuff. And, you know, things went retro, so I did all the traditional stuff. And, you know, I finally came around full circle to the point where I was like, I love this black and gray kind of raw, you know, style to that, but I want to take it and push it a step further. So that's when I started trying to develop the black and gray realism, and, you know, eventually got to where I am now. So
you have become very well known for this black and gray realism that you do, to the point that you have been able to speak to literally thousands of tattoo aficionados all across the world, LA, being in France. What have some of your experiences traveling around and talking about tattoos helped you learn about yourself and learn about your art?
It's so substantial. And, you know, the further I've gotten into it personally, the more humbling it's become. You know, we all go through, I think, and no matter what you do, if you find a focus in something that you're passionate about, you're going to go through different phases in that. And I went from knowing nothing and being this kid just trying to prove himself to getting where you get a big head, you know, and you have all these people telling you you're great. So then you're awesome and you get in that phase. And then if you're smart in that phase, you get out and you get away from everybody that's telling you you're great, and you put yourself around greatness. And then you realize that you're really not that great anymore. And, you know, and it's the same thing about speaking and teaching to people about tattooing and things of that nature. I remember the first time I was ever asked to speak, you know, at a seminar, because that's a fairly new concept in itself, you know, getting out and speaking and teaching in masses. Before, tattooing was very one-on-one, handed down mentor to apprentice. And still it is. You know, there's no really accredited or appreciated tattoo schools, per se. But a friend of mine decided to put on a deal called the Evergreen Invitational. And a very accomplished artist by the name of Joshua Carlton. And he invited myself and a small handful of other artists to go and speak to people about our styles and, you know, what and everything. And it wasn't until that point the actual moment of, you know, I had written all this stuff. I'd come up with a slideshow. I'd put everything together and rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed. And it wasn't until the point that I got up on stage and I looked out over the sea of people that I realized that I had never been taught how to tattoo. I had never heard from someone else's mouth how this should be done. And my biggest instruction was just do what I do. Like, there was no like set guideline of what I should be doing. So I went completely blank, and everything that I had rehearsed, everything that I thought of, just went completely out the window and turned into a mess. And so at that point right there, I just started speaking from the heart. Like, I couldn't tell people how to tattoo. And it was an awakening for me that I can do this, but I really don't know how to do this, you know. And, you know, that's led me into becoming a better tattooer, because I really started going back and focusing on why do I do these things, you know, not just doing them. Why do I do them? And that has allowed me to change what I do. But I started speaking to everybody from the heart, and it came from a place of, I started here. I got to the point to where, you know, I thought that I was great and I had it all figured out. And it had actually, at that point, I became stagnant as an artist, because I wasn't trying to get any better. I wasn't putting myself around people that pushed me to be better. I was standing in a room full of people that everybody thought that I was the best. And when you get to that point as an artist, you're no longer producing art that challenges you and you're excited about. You're just redoing the same regurgitated formula you've done. And so I spent almost 2 hours talking to a room full of people about how I came from that and got re-inspired and pushing myself to do different things. And in that, I had an awakening for myself to go on and do greater things, which led to me doing more public speaking in a motivational sense, not a tattooing sense. At the end of it, I had people crying, and unintentionally just opened up a whole new side of things for me. So since I've been able to learn how to teach how to tattoo more to people in a better verbal sense, my apprentices now that I've taught since then, I feel I'm like I've become a better teacher. And, you know, it's just been a very inspiring thing to be able to go out and not just talk tattooing, but be able to talk life with people and have them leave and be more inspired.
You're hearing from Lefty Colbert. He is an artist working in Central Texas and co-owner of Infamous Ink Tattoo Studio. Not only are you spending time coming up with designs and drawing, but you're also running a business. There's a major real world side to this where you don't just get to sit in a chair and doodle. You have to be dealing with things like payroll, rent. I know that the COVID-19 pandemic presented some really unique challenges for the tattoo industry. What was some of the struggles that you had reopening the business, and how are you able to keep your team afloat and happy throughout the period?
Yeah, definitely a crazy thing there. Mine and my wife's idea for business, and the biggest change we did with Infamous when we took it from Southern Culture, is we wanted to do a community-based business that didn't have any advertising, didn't have billboards. We didn't do all the normal things you would do to try to popularize a business. We wanted it to just be based off of giving everything we could to our community and hoping that came back to us in return. So that was our formula. Everything we do, we just go straight to the community. Instead of taking an advertising budget and buying a billboard, we would take that $2,000 and do an autism benefit or some kid's cancer fund or something. And so we started doing that, and it kind of as a grassroots thing built us up to being what we are in the community, which I think ultimately is what got us through the COVID thing. We shut down in the order we were asked to shut down with everyone, which put us in a category with hair salons, nail salons, which, you know, we're not the same as, but I understand why they shut us down in that order. And I respected it. You know, I respected people's fears. I honestly look forward to a little bit of time off, because it's something that we don't have a lot of, and I've got 4 kids. And so me and my wife, we made the decision, okay, we're going to close along with this. We'll comply and do everything the same. At the time, we had 13 people that aren't employees of our shop. You know, something that a lot of people don't understand about a tattoo shop is each artist is an independent contractor. It's similar to a nail salon in that sense that they have a space in our shop, but they're their own boss. So one thing that that did that hindered us is that we weren't available, or the word's not available, we weren't applicable for a PPP loan, which would have allowed us to pay everybody and keep everything rolling. So basically, we just went out to all of our guys and we're like, look, if you have something that's due that can't be waived, if anything's pressing, if you need money for anything, me and my wife will do the best we can to try to support y'all and do it. And so that's what we did. We went home, we started doing things. You know, I was painting and trying to do anything I could to make an additional income. We did a lot of fun stuff with our kids as far as trying to give them a brighter side and our neighbors a brighter side. We would make these care packages with like bottles of water, rolls of toilet paper, some flowers and candy, and like find elderly people in the neighborhood. And our kids did Ding Dong Ditch, where you'd run up with a care package, put it on their doorstep and ring their doorbell and then run back to the car. So they didn't have to be afraid of the COVID stuff or whatever. And we were having a lot of fun with it to the point where it started getting really heavy on the people that did work for us. It started getting heavy on us. I mean, we all have mortgages and things. And like I said, we weren't in a category to where we could get these loans. And so we were faced with some decisions to make. You know, we were told, okay, well, if you have employees, then you could be, you know, where you could get the PPP loans. So what I did is I reached out to our Doc Anderson. He is our
The state representative.
State rep, yep. And I was like, okay, I need to, not just for my shop, but for all tattoo shops, we need to get in contact with the governor and put something in line to where as we reopen, we can have safe provisions as a tattoo shop. We can have a new opening procedure that's going to be like, whenever this date comes, our stations are going to need this. We need this type of sterilization, this type of separation, barriers. Like, we are going to have to be set up differently than we were before. Let's work together, come up with these guidelines, so then I can hire my artists as employees and they can do the work to set their stuff back up. We can do that further training, and then we'll be applicable for the PPP loans so I can actually pay them. That was the plan. Didn't work.
Yeah, let me guess. It didn't work out that easily.
No. They didn't want to hear anything I had to say.
Do you think this is because, like, you're the tattoo guy, you're showing up with tattoos on your face and so they don't take you seriously? Or is this really a larger issue?
It is. You know, and I don't hold them at fault for it, but it's like I've said in the past, they get their hair cut. They get their nails done. You know, the people that are in those positions, they're not out getting tattooed. So, you know, I don't think it's something that they're faced with on a daily basis. So it's not something that they have to look at. But that's also something that they don't realize is that it has become such a big industry that affects so many people. And so jumping forward, when they started reopening things and doing all that, was right about the time that I got tax bills from the city for property tax, which has increased substantially around Waco. If anybody's paid attention over the past couple of years and you own a house.
We've been tracking it on Downtown Depot for years.
Yeah, and it's been like, wow. So a substantial tax increase. The offices were not available to go there because of COVID. So I couldn't really protest the tax bills. So I contacted them and I was like, hey, our businesses are closed. We're not unable to make an income. Can I have the penalties and interest waived on taxes? Not trying to not pay them, but can I have those waived to where when we can reopen, then we can get back right on track? No, absolutely not. Not if it's not unless it's from a state order. Okay. So I contacted the health department and I was like, where does this put us as far as with the health department? They're like, well, we can't say whether you can open or close. You're not breaking any violations with us if you're open. Okay. So when it came to the point that they opened hair salons and nail salons, like, we were all tattoo artists all across the state, all everywhere, were sitting there just waiting on that press conference because we thought that we were going to be in on that. And then it didn't come. And so it was like, okay, what do we do? we were told, not going to say who, but we were told by some in the city that, you know what, put paper over your windows, do it discreetly, and there shouldn't be an issue. Issue with me in that is it's not breaking a law. Like, it's our business. It's what we do for a living, and we wanted to be able to do that legally. And so we made the conscious decision, me and my wife and a handful of our artists, to reopen right along with hair salons. We did our own provisions. We did our own safety and everything like that. We did it to the highest standard we could possibly do it to reopen and to provide for our artists and our families. And it has been the biggest outpouring of support from the community that we started and based upon that I could ever imagine. And we still have a lot pending on that. So we still have court trials with the city and everything because we got fined every day for being open. So we'll see where that leads.
Well, 2020 was a incredible year. And I use the word incredible in that it's hard to believe some of the things that happened in 2020 when we look back on it. And you have people telling you, hey, just put paper up on the walls. You'll be fine. No one will notice. But I love the fact that in this industry that I think from the outside seems like there's maybe some criminal aspects or the ne'er-do-wells are the ones getting tattooed. It's really fascinating to see how permeated the culture has become with tattooing.
Yeah.
And to hear someone like you who is a leader in the industry, who's in Central Texas, encouraging his kids to ding dong and ditch on the grandparents in the community so they can have toilet paper and the necessities that they need. You are doing a great job of being a bearer for the tattoo community worldwide, and particularly here in Central Texas. It's just an honor to have you on here.
I appreciate it.
Lefty Colbert is the co-owner of Infamous Inc. here in town and an artist working in Central Texas. Where can folks find you if they want to connect with you online?
We have Facebook, Instagram, everything, your websites. If you look up Infamous Inc. in Waco in any way, shape, or form, you're going to find us. Same thing with myself personally, Lefty Colbert. Me and my wife, Shauna, are available to answer questions, do anything we can, anytime. And, you know, we're always here to not only take care of tattooing stuff for people, but anything that's community-based that we can help out with our business, we're in 100%. So.
Thanks so much for coming on Downtown Depot, Lefty.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Lefty Colbert of Infamous Inc. and to you for tuning in to episode 105 of Downtown Depot here on Waco Public Radio. I'll be back on Friday, June 18th, but be sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Waco Business News to stay up to date in between recordings. I'm Austin Meek, Waco Business News, and you've been listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business.